coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Peering into the murky abyss, Spock saw something he had never seen before. Not a vision, not a light, but a feeling. A feeling he didn't understand. Wonderment.
Descartes said that the purpose of wonderment is to get us to learn and remember.
But why does wonder have to have a purpose?
You want to waste your life staring slack-jawed at rainbows?
You want science to take all the joy out of rainbows?
I stand in awe of existence.
You're gonna tie me up.
It's important to nourish your mind as well as your body.
Our guest is Helen DeCruz from St. Louis University, author of Wonderstruck, How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think.
What makes you go wow?
In awe of wonder, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program, so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This year, it's been everything from cancel culture to contradictions, from wise women to weird wants.
So head on over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click Support Us at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosopher in your life with a subscription to our library of nearly 600 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk. Where does our sense of wonder come from?
Does wonder have a purpose, or is it gloriously useless?
How can we pay more attention to marvelous things?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're standing in awe of wonder.
Wonder is such a cool emotion, and we can feel it towards so many things. The stars above us, the beauty of nature all around us, the artistic feats that human beings are capable of.
Yeah, and not just big things either. Watching a hummingbird in your garden, hearing a beautiful guitar solo, or feeling the sand underneath your feet at the beach. Those things can fill you with wonder, too.
Right, and these experiences are always inspiring. They comfort us, they motivate us, they add to the richness of life. It's like Rachel Carson said, if you have a sense of wonder, you're never really alone.
I don't know about that always inspiring part, Josh. The cosmos is wonderful, but think about what Blaise Pascal said. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces terrifies me. I'm not convinced that experiences of wonder are always so positive.
Okay, that's a fair point. I mean, sometimes we can get overwhelmed by stuff we don't understand, but still, a lot of the time, wonder feels miraculous. Plus, it's also useful.
Useful? How is it useful to sit in your garden staring at a hummingbird for 2 hours?
Because it motivates us to get curious, you know, to find stuff out about the world. Remember what Socrates says in Plato's Theaetetus. Wonder is the origin of philosophy.
I'm not so sure about that. Look, when I was 14, I had this friend with a Ouija board, and it seemed pretty mysterious, and it filled us with wonder. We read a whole bunch of books about ghosts and spirits. That was fun, but I wouldn't exactly call it knowledge.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't either. Okay, so it turned out in your case there weren't any actual ghosts, but I don't know. I still think the Ouija board probably did something useful for you. It kept your mind open to new possibilities. Not all strange things turn out to be true, but some do. And it's good to be on the lookout for when that happens.
No, it's only good to be on the lookout for strange possibilities if you're right more often than you're wrong. And most of the time, the world is pretty mundane.
Most of the time it's mundane. What about black holes? What about dark matter? Yeah, a quantum entanglement? Or the fact that the universe had a beginning or didn't have a beginning? I think the universe is a wild and wacky place. And wonder fills us with respect for that wildness and wackiness.
You know, your problem is that you think that wonder has to have a point. You say it fills us with respect. It keeps us open to new possibilities. It sets us on the path to knowledge. Why not just relax and enjoy the ride?
Why can't we do both? I mean, I love disappearing into an experience of wonder as much as the next person. I love letting that time drift away while I sit staring at a Rothko painting. But once I'm done staring, I often feel like going to the library and checking out a bunch of art history books.
Yeah, I still think looking at it that way makes you miss out. You're intellectualizing your feelings. You're acting like they have to be about something. Why can't you get out of your head and into your heart?
But feelings are always about something. I mean, if I feel afraid, it's because there's something scary out there. If I feel angry, it's because somebody hurt me. And if I feel wonder, it's because I'm seeing something surprising and unexplained. Your head is involved in all of these emotions, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, you're saying that the whole point of wonder is that it motivates you to explain things. And that just can't be right. Finding explanations encourages your sense of wonder. It doesn't make it go away. If your sense of wonder went away every time you found an explanation, that would be tragic.
Who says the world isn't tragic? Maybe it's like Proust says. Once you understand a piece of music, there's one more bit of knowledge in the world and one less bit of beauty.
I hope not. Maybe our guest will be able to set both of our minds at ease. It's Helen DeCruz, author of Wonderstruck: How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think.
And speaking of being wonderstruck, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk to people who find wonder in all kinds of things, from the farthest reaches of the cosmos to incredibly close confines. She files this report.
Ooh!
Mmm.
Ouch.
Yum, yum.
Those are all examples of vocal bursts. And then there's whoa. Dacher Keltner examines woes in his book, Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. Keltner is a psychology professor and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. He writes that woe is one of the most universal human sounds, and it conveys the emotion we call awe.
It was really the birth of my first daughter, Natalie, where I was just blown away and awestruck, and I felt like my life had been transformed.
His team was struggling with how to study awe. They gathered stories from 26 different countries, asking people to tell a story of an experience with awe. One of the stories from his book comes from a cellist named Yumi Kendall, who plays for the Philadelphia Orchestra.
She said, well, you know, when I start playing music and I think about the notes I play, I realize like I'm part of this human tradition of music that's thousands of years old. It's probably 80,000 years old.
The vibrations coming out of the cello produce sounds that flow into space.
She's like, God, the notes vibrate in my body, and then I'm part of this symphony, and we're part of producing these sounds, and I understand the meaning. It feels like a cashmere blanket of sound.
Kendall talks about playing Mozart's Requiem in the Science of Happiness podcast. A requiem is a mass for the dead, and she thought of her grandfather.
Then it suddenly changes, like 20 seconds in, to this angelic, like bright white light, like the heavens opened, and is super peaceful, soprano singing, angels, angel voices kind of feeling. And I got goosebumps. I felt like grandfather was listening.
Keltner says answering the question of why music is so powerful may be one of his last acts in the world of awe. With questions comes wonder.
In science, wonder seems like a developmental stage that you go through to get to knowledge. And it's a kind of temporary state where the questions are popping everywhere, and then you figured it out and you know things.
That's Elizabeth Kessler, a lecturer in American Studies at Stanford and author of Picturing the Cosmos, Hubble Space Telescope Images and the Astronomical Sublime.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us.
Before the astronomical sublime got to her, Kessler was interested in romanticism and landscape paintings.
But I started seeing a lot of the astronomical images that were online, whether it was views from very early Mars rovers to the then early Hubble Space Telescope images. And it struck me that many of them looked like romantic landscape paintings and photographs.
For instance, the Pillars of Creation.
The choice of colors there indicate scientific information. They speak to the relative wavelengths of the different observations that were made there. But it also ends up creating a scene with a blue background and these clouds of gas and dust look kind of yellowish, orangish, brownish. So it looks like a kind of landscape.
She says images from the cosmos help us think of possibilities and potential in times of catastrophe. Like in 2022, when NASA released the first images from Hubble's successor, the James Webb Space Telescope.
Light where stars were born and from where they die. Light from the oldest galaxies, the oldest documented light in the history of the universe.
In a moment where we often feel weighted down, whether pandemic, climate change, catastrophe after catastrophe, to have a glimpse of something, even inadequate, that speaks to awe, that speaks to wonder, that speaks to the potential for transcendence, gives us some other way forward.
And we sure could use fewer reasons to murmur,
oh,
or
eek,
and more reasons to go.
Whoa.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly Jimmy-Deed.
Thank you for that wondrous report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy, and with me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. Today, we're thinking about the philosophy of wonder.
We're joined now by Helen DeCruz. She's a professor of philosophy at St. Louis University and author of a forthcoming book titled Wonderstruck: How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think. Helen, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ray.
So, Helen, I know you've been thinking about wonder for many years now. Can you tell us about an early experience that got you thinking about it?
I think the first time that I seriously got to think about wonder was when I was about 12 years old and I just enrolled in the local library. And I come from a very blue-collar family, so we have like the main books we have at home are like cooking books and books on how to fix things. And I was in the library and I wandered off to the section on art history. And I found this book with sketches by Leonardo da Vinci. So there was almost no text. It was just his sketches. And I was so astounded at somebody thinking that way, at both the art and the scientific stuff. Like, I was amazed. I mean, everybody at the time was really into Leonardo DiCaprio, but I was into Leonardo da Vinci.
I kind of feel the same way about da Vinci's drawings. They're so cool. So I've also been kind of wondering about wonder as an emotion. Lots of emotions are useful for day-to-day survival. But why do we do things like stand in front of a beautiful painting or drawing and just stare at it for hours? Does that have any kind of evolutionary advantage?
My view is that yes, it does have an evolutionary advantage. And the problem with evolutionary explanations, particularly of sort of the evolutionary psychological kind, is that they look at function very narrowly. Something like, if it doesn't have any immediate material benefits, then it's not evolutionarily speaking useful. But there are so many situations in which it is important to expand your mind. It's important to, you know, have a restful soul. Like, that sounds very poetic, right? But it's important to, you know, to nourish your mind as well as your body. And I think in that respect, wonder is very useful. It's something that helps you to find out about your environment, to find out things that you didn't know. It opens up things that you didn't know. It makes you aware of them. And it helps you to really look at those things with a sense of, like, I've never seen this before. What could this be? And take it on its own terms. It sort of helps you to get out of your head. And that, I think, is evolutionarily speaking, very, very useful.
Oh, wow. So that's actually two things that you said there. First of all, that it makes me kind of curious and interested in exploring my environment. And second of all, that it's restful. I don't usually think of those things as going together. Do they in the case of wonder?
I think so. I think you need a bit of space, a bit of headspace to experience wonder. Like, I notice that I find it difficult. I find it a struggle to find enough time in my life for wonder. So you need a bit of headspace. And then once you have that, the nice thing is you can sort of let go of all those immediate concerns in your mind and really take an object at its own terms. Like, for example, a Rothko. So a Rothko is something like radically other. It's a beautiful painting that you can really sort of explore and you know, feel into without having to worry about your immediate worries. And that, I think, is something that gives a kind of restfulness that I think is important in wonder.
Oh, I agree so deeply with you, Helen. Thank you so much for saying it so beautifully. The only question I would have is, you know, it's kind of a general question about evolutionary psychology. We can say that that's important in life, very valuable, maybe even useful. But why should we think that it's, you know, an adaptation, that we've sort of evolved to have a sense of wonder?
I think that wonder is adaptive, but I'm not sure if it's an adaptation. So adaptations are things that directly evolve in response to certain problems in our environment. Whereas things that are adaptive are a lot broader. Like, for example, we build houses. Having houses is certainly adaptive, but it's not an adaptation to build houses. And I think actually wonder, like other complex emotions, is like that. So wonder does build on our ability to feel surprise and these sort of like more primitive, more basic emotions. But it is also a cultural emotion. So it's maybe an exaggeration to say that when we, at least in the West in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, engaged in things like magic, in things like the sublime, that our sense of wonder sort of got that kind of cultural filling in, right? With, like, for example, things like Gothic novels of Anne Radcliffe and other people like that. So it is adaptive, but I'm not convinced that it is like a direct adaptation in the sense that, for example, I don't know, teeth are a direct adaptation.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about wonder with Helen DeCruz from St. Louis University.
What's the last thing that filled you with wonder? Did it motivate you to learn more about the world around you? Or did it fill you with reverence for the unknown?
How to illuminate the world with magic, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Could a simple, mundane, but perfect day fill your heart with wonder? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about wonder with Helen DeCruz, author of Wonderstruck, How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think.
What do you wonder about wonder? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and wander through our library of nearly 600 episodes.
So Helen, we were talking earlier about how even if wonder isn't an adaptation in an evolutionary sense, it's still adaptive. But I can imagine somebody objecting, you know, why should wonder have to be useful for anything at all? Shouldn't we just say that it's a beautiful thing with no use? What would you say to that?
I think that there is a kind of dichotomy that we make between the useful and the useless, a dichotomy that I reject. So I think that actually a lot of the things that give value and meaning to our lives are useful to us. So William James, he had this critique a long time ago against a very sort of early version of evolutionary psychology, where he said, you know, if Spencer is right, what about the things that really matter to us? What about the things that make life worth living? Yeah, it's survival of the fittest, but what is that life, a life worth living? And I see wonder in that respect. It's very useful to us, but precisely because it isn't immediately useful to us in a sort of straightforward utilitarian sense.
Yeah, so I can kind of see two different questions here, where one is, what is good about wonder? And it just seems like citing the downstream benefits of wonder is kind of missing the point, even if there are downstream benefits. And there's this other kind of evolutionary question, like, what is the cause of how we're able to feel wonder? So have we been just answering the what is good about wonder question, or the causal question, or somehow both?
Yeah, so in terms of the causes of wonder, I'm on board with what a lot of contemporary emotion researchers say, And that is that emotions are actually things we have that help us to respond to our environment in a very flexible way. So, for example, if you have pain, pain is a feeling, but it's not an emotion, then you have to react to the pain. It's very, very difficult to ignore. But emotions are a lot more flexible. For example, you can become really angry, but you can try to suppress the anger in a way that's easier, in a sense, than suppressing pain, unless like the pain is very light and the anger is very big. And in that respect, I think that wonder is similar. So wonder is an emotion that helps you to become aware of your environment and to become, to sort of step out of yourself. It's a self-transcendent emotion, and it helps you to obtain knowledge about the world.
So it seems like there's a kind of a bundle of advantages of feeling wonder. So it, as you say, helps you to learn about the world. It overcomes, it's self-transcendent, overcomes your obsessive focus on yourself. I know you've also talked about how it can break our categories, right? It can kind of move us out of whatever conceptual scheme we're currently trapped in. And then there's the thing that I might maybe like the most, which is restoring a sense of marvel, beauty, excitement about the world. It reminds me of something Susan Sontag said. She wrote that the conditions of modern life conjoin to dull our sensory faculties. What is important now is to recover our senses. We must learn to see more, to hear more, to feel more. And wonder does that, right? I mean, it breaks the hold of our habits of seeing and thinking, and allows us to have a fresh gaze upon the world. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, so I think definitely the problem is that we fall into ruts. So some of the great major theorists about wonder are Abraham Heschel and Maurice Merleau-Ponty. I'll just briefly mention Heschel. So Heschel says the problem is eventually you just sort of get into these ruts where you take things for granted, even really marvelous things like science and the products of science. Like you eat food, the food comes onto your plate due to this really complex chain of all sorts of technological innovations. That's how you can eat food from all over the world. But you just don't realize it anymore. So you get, in a sense, blunted. And what wonder helps you to do is to try to recover that sense of, this is really amazing and cool. This is something special. And so Heschel was really concerned with trying to recover this so that we wouldn't, in fact, sort of take things for granted and just sort of sleepwalk through life.
This actually helps me with a question that Josh and I were talking about earlier, about how you can learn things and be not less filled with wonder and more filled with wonder. So if the things that you're learning are surprising and make the subject that you're studying seem surprising, where before you were just like, oh, that's a boring feature of my life, like that does seem like a way to cultivate wonder.
That is definitely right. So it has been a long discussion in the 18th century about whether you have to be ignorant to wonder. And the side I come down on is Adam Smith. Adam Smith thinks that actually, even though a scientist, so he talks about astronomy, and the book is A History of Astronomy, even though you try to find out about things like comets and things like eclipses, things that fill you with wonder, and then you realize how does an eclipse happen, and you lose that sense of wonder because you say, oh yeah, it's because of that. But once you know more, new questions start coming. You know what scientists or philosophers of science call anomalies, and then you become open to that. But in order to understand these anomalies or to see them, you have to have a framework. So you have to have already know something. So I think in that sense, wonder, at least in science, is self-perpetuating, because you learn more and more things, and that makes you open to more and more strange and wondrous things.
This actually connects to an email question that we got from Hannah in Connecticut. Hannah asks this, wonder often is a catalyst for further inquiry, which then leads to discoveries that explain or debunk the very phenomena that inspired wonder in the first place. In this way, wonder almost seems to be self-annihilating, especially in our modern world that's obsessed with knowing. Isn't there something to be said for remaining in that state of wonder or awe rather than trying to transcend it? What do you think, Helen?
I love this question. So I think that, yes, there is something in science that is a bit of a paradox in that scientists indeed try to lessen the sense of wonder. They don't want to wonder. So as Adam Smith says about the history of astronomy, you have those early astronomers and they look at these eclipses and they don't say, oh, wow, an eclipse, how wonderful. Oh, wow, a comet, how great. No, they want to understand, like, what is this? What is a comet? What is an eclipse? How does it go? How can I find out when a new eclipse comes? And then their sense of wonder dissipates. However, there's always new things to discover. So I think when you become aware of your limitations, which wonder helps you to become aware of, there's always new things to discover. That's why I'm on the side of not staying ignorant and just going for it. There's always new and marvelous things that we can find out.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about wonder with Helen DeCruz from St. Louis University. Helen, this kind of brings up a question for me about the appropriate role of aesthetic feelings in science. Like, wonder is kind of an aesthetic feeling. It's an appreciation of beauty. And so some of the scientists that you were citing might think that there's no room for aesthetic feelings, that science is supposed to be objective. Is that right? What do you think?
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, I think that scientists, like, maybe this goes back to the idea of the context of justification and the context of discovery that people like Popper, other philosophers of science talk about. And I think actually there's something to that. So I think that you can, as a scientist, have the craziest ideas, the weirdest thoughts about how do I come to this thing? Like, it could be something completely idiosyncratic. But then once you begin, you do have to try to do your best to be objective. You have to really subject your theories to rigorous testing. But I think in those early processes of discovery and of just thinking around it, that it's very important to let your emotions guide you, because our emotions are useful. And as I've said earlier, our emotions are the sorts of things that help us to learn about the world. So scientists should use those emotions. And aesthetic emotions, you know, of beauty, of awe, of finding something marvelous and intricate, are very important in their work.
That seems right, because there was that long tradition starting with people like John Keats, the poet, complaining about science unweaving the rainbow, disenchanting the world, taking all the mystery out of things. But you have a bunch of scientists saying, actually, my world is greatly enchanted precisely because of all the things that I've learned about it. And it makes me think maybe there are two ways of thinking about this. So one is what you were saying a moment ago, which is even when you understand a bunch of stuff, there's still stuff to be understood, and you're discovering new areas of your own ignorance, which is in some ways enchanting. Another is the very knowledge that you come up with can itself be beautiful and enchanting. I think of that line from Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? And so maybe it doesn't, the mystery and the enchantment doesn't last forever, but surely, you know, these incredible pictures, for example, that we're seeing from the Webb telescope that we were hearing about earlier, these are enchanting, right? These are wonder-inducing. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is can't we have wonder from knowledge and not just from ignorance?
I think that we can. This was actually a big discussion in the 18th century. Immanuel Kant thought that the sublime, and the sublime is sort of like this sense of wonder and awe that you get at like really deep valleys and like storms and you know, tempestuous seas. So Kant thought that you needed to have a sense of safety and that you need to have basically be ignorant. But Herder thought that actually we can find also wonder in what we know. It's sort of like it opens up this sense of like, wow, the scope of this is enormous. And the only way in which you can learn about the scope of, for example, take, say, particle physics, to not take an 18th century example, thinking about those different particles and how they might relate, and now the theory with the fields, so all these particles are in different fields. It's amazing, right? To think that reality is fundamentally or might be fundamentally like that. So there you find wonder within the knowledge, and not just merely in the fact that we don't know everything there is to know or what whether there's dark matter and things like that.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to see some of these philosophers, Adam Smith saying we should get rid of that wonder, that uncertainty, and anxious curiosity. Kind of reminds me of some of the ancient skeptics. But I'm kind of temperamentally disposed towards the beauty and the wonder of wonder. But I sometimes think about the dark side, right? So, I mean, we heard from Ray earlier Pascal's line about the terrifying immensity of space. And we could think about, the Ouija board. We could think about cases where wonder leads you astray. We could think about, the danger of following charismatic leaders or falling down conspiracy theory rabbit holes. How dangerous could a sense of wonder be?
I think that wonder can be dangerous. I'm using Descartes as a guideline, where he actually says that once you learn something, he says, well, it's altogether better to stop wandering. So once you've acquired knowledge, you just stop wandering. Because his worry is if you continue wandering, then you just fall into a rabbit hole. Like, imagine that you watch like flat earth videos. These were really cool and well, not cool. They were horrible. But a few years ago, my students showed me like flat earth videos, and they were like 3-hour video essays on YouTube. And they were so filled with wonder. It was just impossible. Like, do you think the earth is really round? Do you see that imagery? Well, it's all fake. And I thought, this is where indeed Descartes is right. There is a certain unhealthy way to engage the emotion of wonder, just like other emotions can become unhealthy. So we do have to regulate our habits, at least in such a way that our sense of wonder remains healthy, I think.
You've mentioned a couple of instances of people wondering at things that just aren't true. Like, I can't wonder at the flatness of the earth if the earth isn't flat, or I shouldn't, maybe. I'm kind of wondering how this fits in with some of the things that you say in the book about magic. So stage magic is all about creating illusions for people to wonder at. Is that all right, or is it just kind of seducing them with lies?
It depends a bit how you do it. So many stage magicians, like Darren Brown, for example, say that we shouldn't give people the impression that we are really working wonders or that we are really communing with the dead. That particularly is really awful. So people, they want to talk to their dead loved ones. And, you have lots of magicians who sort of do that. But it's totally okay as a performance art. And so the way I conceive of it in the book is as a performance art, where you create an effect of impossibility. So the audience knows that the assistant of the magician is not really being sawed in half. The audience knows that pigeon didn't just come out of that hat. So then the question that didn't just materialize there, well, it did come out of the hat. But then the question is like, okay, this is impossible, and yet I see it happen. So how did it happen? So the main thing about it is the how, but that's not the only thing. The whole thing is a magic show also has to be beautiful, has to tell a story, has to be interesting. And all those things, I think, make it more than just like wondering at the impossible.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite historical figures is a 19th century French magician called Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin. Houdini named himself after this guy. And he was kind of a pioneer in creating the stage magic we see today, where it isn't people pretending to commune with the spirits, but it's, regular evening wear, nothing up my sleeve. And where, just as you're saying, Helen, it's all about an illusion that is presented as an illusion. And it seems like that's a really interesting move forward, where we have this kind of wonder that, as a colleague of mine says, delights but does not deceive, right? A very modern way of getting wonder back into the world in a totally secular way that doesn't depend on belief in spirits and ghosts and goblins.
Yeah, I love that. I like the idea that wonder does not depend on gullibility. So if you are somebody who wanders a lot, you're not particularly a gullible person or something. Like, you could be a healthy skeptic and yet make room for wonder in your life. And one of the things that I found in my research on stage magic is there's many different ways in which you can engage with it. Some people are just happy to see the trick. Other people keep on thinking, okay, how is this done? And they will not rest. They will go to home, to YouTube, to try to find out how is this trick done. Other people just love the sort of the aesthetic parts of the performance. So there's so many different ways. There's not just one right way to wander. There's many different ways in which you can do it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about wonder with Helen DeCruz, author of Wonderstruck, How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think.
Do you want to cultivate more wonder in your life? Or do you think it's a big waste of time? Would the world be a better place if we all took time to smell the roses?
The strange, the striking, and the spectacular. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. We really are made of star stuff. Doesn't that fill you with a sense of wonder? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Helen DeCruz from St. Louis University, and we're thinking about wonder.
So Helen, do you think there's a way we can harness our sense of wonder to bring about a better world?
I think we should do it. So Rachel Carson, she was a big advocate for that. She was, of course, an amazing advocate for conservation. She was arguing against the use of pesticides or the overuse of pesticides. And she thought, like, there is this tendency to look away. Like, you see all sorts of horrors. I think it's so actual. Like, you see a lot of horrors in the world and you look away. And so you get blunted, like you're already blunted by just like the everyday world where you have to, like, you know, work and put food on the table and things like that. But if you can make a space, you have to make some space in your life, some emptiness in your life, then you can look again at things. And it's an important precondition in order to change the world. Like, you can't despair. When you despair, then there's just not even the possibility of making changes that could individually or collectively help.
So when I think about the environment and wonder, this kind of brings me back to one of the questions that Josh asked about wonder being kind of terrifying and depressing. So a lot of the things in the environment that provoke wonder are beautiful animals or beautiful ecosystems that climate change is going to destroy if we don't do something. Is it possible to decouple the wonder from the despair?
That's difficult. I think in a sense not, because when you become acutely aware of how marvelous and how beautiful it is, your immediate thought about this is in danger becomes more salient. I've been doing a lot of interviews. This is for Work in Progress with natural scientists. So I did a lot of interviews with them, an hour each, and I interviewed about 30. And there were a lot of climate scientists. And they clearly had this sense, like they are not okay, these people right now. Mm-hmm. So they do have a lot of sense of wonder at the beauty of nature. And many of them are super outdoorsy as well. Like they hike and they climb mountains. But they also like this sense of, like, we should spread the wonder. Like, lots of people really need this in their lives. And it will help us to, you know, to restore the world around us and to be more wholesome within that world.
I like this way that you just put it of spreading the wonder. And maybe part of the problem with the climate scientists is that they feel wonder at the natural environment, but it's not being reflected by the people around them enough and not motivating the people around them enough. So do you have advice for how to spread and share wonder with the people around you?
I think just like local small initiatives, like, for example, in Forest Park in St. Louis, where I live, there's like an owl walk regularly, mm-hmm. where you go and look at owls. And that's just so amazing. Like, there's so many owls, so many different ones. So it doesn't have to be like big and world changing. It could be like small initiatives, like just walking around in nature, because so many of us are alienated from nature. And thinking about how we can bring that to people like who normally don't get that opportunity. So people who live in very urban and deprived environments could get this sense of wonder as well. So trying to democratize it, like wonder is not just something for wealthy people with a lot of time on their hands. It's for everyone. And try to help people to, you know, to find it in their everyday life.
That's a beautiful point, because you could just be walking down the street and suddenly a butterfly lands on a flower growing out of the crack in the sidewalk. And that's available to everybody, but it's only really available if somehow there's a space in our mental life for it, right? Which brings me to a related question, which is, I mean, I think you've answered beautifully, how do we make wonder available to others? What about making it available to ourselves, right? We do get trapped into habits and routines, and it's hard for us, you know, to stop and smell the roses. What advice do you have for someone who wants to have more wonder in their life?
The paradoxical thing that I'm going to say now is that you should not do it in order to become more productive or anything. Like, I really, really dislike those articles in BBC and New York Times about make some awe walks and work against burnout at work. I'd say no. This is a problem, right? We have too much work pressure. Like, the environment is degrading. You know, people, like, there's all these problems that you know, prices are rising. You know, those are external problems that need to be fixed. And wonder is not the fix for them. Wonder is there for you. But it shouldn't be sort of used for you to achieve some end, like being productive. It should just be there for you and for nothing else, or for you and the people you love and you want to share with. Now, the traditional way in which that has been done, and that Abraham Joshua Heschel talks about, is religion. So religion is one way in which people can make wonder in their lives. But you don't have to be religious. I think it's important to just like use some mindfulness or any sort of technique that works for you to like take a bit of space in your life that doesn't have to be productive. Like, if you have a lot of work, if you work like two jobs or something, it could be really short, but it's still important to make the space. And, you know, 10 minutes can be found. So you could start small with things like that.
So actually, the religion point raises more questions for me too. Because on the one hand, religion can do many valuable things. It can bring people together. On the other hand, religion has not been totally non-destructive. So I wonder if there are religious misuses of wonder and how to prevent oneself from doing that and maybe encourage others not to do that either.
I'm now going with Merleau-Ponty's sort of concept of wonder. So Merleau-Ponty was very critical of religion, particularly of Catholicism, which was the religion with which he grew up with. But at the same time, he recognized that religions like Catholicism really help people to have this sense of wonder. So in this case, like, he was a Frenchman, you had like these huge masses with like beautiful music coming out of big organs and like all sorts of beautiful clothes and, you know, smells. So the thing is that I think there is a worry that religion might monopolize the sorts of feelings that really matter to us. And the worry then is if religion does that, if it monopolizes the things that really matter to us and say, like, this is the way and no other way, then they can use that for all sorts of ends, like very spooky political ends as well, and become really destructive. So I think it's very important, like, even if you are religious, I would resist religion monopolizing your wonder. Like, you can find it in many different ways, and it's important to be aware of many different sources of wonder. Don't, like, take it just from one source.
Right, including, I would say, something dear to my heart and to yours, Helen, the realm of art. There are some famous theorists who claim that that's one of the main roles of art, is to defamiliarize the world for us, to make the everyday seem strange again. Let me give you one example that I like from the world of science fiction, the movie 12 Monkeys. 12 Monkeys sketches out a sort of post-nuclear world where you can't go on the surface. And thanks to time travel, the main character goes back in time. And there's a great scene where he's just driving around in the passenger seat and hanging his head out of the window like a dog, just because breathing air is so amazing. And that's, a fantastic way that, you know, one example of many, how art can reenchant the world for us. Art can deliver back to us our world, but with a sense of how extraordinary it is. We get to breathe air. What do you think about art as a resource for wonder?
So like you, I really, really love science fiction and fantasy. I love it because it makes the familiar look utterly strange, and it gives you an appreciation for that. But I agree, like any kind of art is capable of doing that. Like what artists basically do is help us to see things in a new way. Like, you know, this is like what Oscar Wilde said about mists and vapors. He said, like, it's not that actually we only began to see them when the Impressionists started painting them. Even though there were mists and vapors before, like you had trains, you had steamboats, but then you had Impressionists and the people just before, like Turner, painting them. Then people became aware that they are interesting and beautiful and special. And art is like that. Like that's why it's good to go to a museum sometimes, and lots of them are free, and to just enjoy the way that other people look at things and bring out strangers, and it can help you to find the wondrousness as well.
Helen, this conversation has been both wonderful and marvelous. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Helen DeCruz, professor of philosophy at St. Louis University and author of the forthcoming book, Wonderstruck: How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
I'm thinking I've been working too hard and I'd like to spend an evening at the Exploratorium.
What a great idea. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and listen in wonder, we hope, to our nearly 600 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we may feature it on the blog.
Now, so fast, he's the eighth wonder of the world. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the word wonder is often used by preachers to get us to stop thinking about how horrible things are and ponder instead the wonders of childbirth, breakfast, and things that do not involve voting. We can wonder about things like bacteria and gravity and wonder at things like the Alps. Wondrous concepts are the beating heart of religion, love, stadium events, 3D sensorround viewing experiences, and tourism. But they are thin on the ground these days. Authors of children's books are often called wonderful, if they do their own illustrations. Dr. Seuss is wonderful, not as much as he used to be, when he's more about the oobleck than Cat in the Hat. To think that I Saw It on Mulberry Street is gone from the shelves, though nobody's actually read it since 1962. Things we once saw on Mulberry Street are now problematic. And once problematic enters in, wonderful goes out the window, unless you're a fascist, which we all are, really, when it comes to spectacle anyway. Who doesn't love a parade? There used to be seven wonders of the world, which seems kind of skimpy now. I only know about them from newsreels we used to watch in the furnace room at Lewis and Clark Grade School, a low-slung building without one tinge of wonder in it. Experience of wonder is evidence of something beyond our ken. It's become diluted over the years because we experience things more than we used to, through books, movies, television, records, microscopes, telescopes, and inside those experiences, manipulating the wonderful through slow motion, extreme close-ups, sound effects, bombastic symphony or heavy metal music to make the wonderfulness that much more awesome. Until it is all eclipsed by repetition, until the Easter Island heads and Tiki heads and the Rushmore heads merge into one big cartoon, which, oddly enough, does not affect the experience of seeing Mount Rushmore in real life. Just like the Colossus of Rhodes, a former wonder of the world long gone, existing as a movie starring Rory Calhoun, the first movie directed by Sergio Leone, 1961, would not affect our viewing of the real Colossus should Elon Musk decide to build one. And Leone went on to make some wonderful westerns, making Clint Eastwood a star, even a monument. See how it all ties in? If I'd seen the bare rock face of Rushmore before sculpting began, I might have been struck with wonder just by that, nature being what it is and all, but not the same wonder as now, tempered as it was by immediately wondering why Teddy Roosevelt is included up there, nothing against the guy. All presidents are problematic now, as a fact. But you know, in America, it's restful now to believe the worst about authority figures. And oddly, it doesn't take the edge off wonder if you remember that Rushmore is not that far, really, from where Custer met his end. Which reminds me, when I was a kid in a small town a bit north of Rushmore, some local Cub Scouts were part of a special event using the high school auditorium, which is also where Nixon spoke when he came there. The kids reenacted Custer's last stand right there in the basketball court, with two-thirds of the Scouts playing Indians, swapping out their Scout attire for various manifestations of what 10-year-old boys imagined Indians might wear. Apaches, Arapaho, whatever. Feathers and tomahawks, bows and arrows, and whooping. They're the boys of the doomed cavalry, with the blondest kid as Custer, cap guns popping like firecrackers. They didn't even have to swap out their blue Cub Scout uniforms, just followed their traces with blood-curdling cries, merit badges showing where blood might have been had they been shot. It was wonderful and cost-effective. My mother thought it was a bit bloodthirsty for these modern times, but then mothers have a hard time finding the wonder in Westerns, especially if they grew up in the West on a farm that went bust. I learned later my father had been a scout leader and discovered his troop was a shoplifting ring. Nowadays, we'd regard that as valuable training for resistance to Antifa incursions. Or we'd just blame Biden and walk away. Though there's a Crazy Horse monument in the works, bound to be unveiled any century now, Rushmore, I'd say, is immune from cancel culture. Unless you have a truck full of nitroglycerin, which would make an awesome explosion, but not so wonderful, really. Still, you could build a monument to Ozymandias where it once stood, or a stately pleasure dome, have Trump decree it, or keep it as it is and put Trump's head in there. Maybe replace Teddy Roosevelt, who always looked like he was photobombing the monument anyway. Build it with lasers to save time. I have a feeling Trump would enjoy something like that, and frankly, despite his ambitions, it doesn't seem like Trump gets much pleasure out of life. It's all such a complicated wonder, really, isn't it? Life, I mean. Many wonders are. Seldom today is one truly agog. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Don't compromise. Compromise is a language of the devil. Run in God's name and let the world stand back in wonder.